Good morning, Chief Justice Steele, Justice Holland, Justice Jacobs. May it please the court. With the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Yes.
Today there are three issues for the court's consideration. This is the case of Kevin Moore v. State.
Would you pull the mic a little closer?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. My name is Josh Meyerhoff. I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Kevin Moore. The way I frame the argument is there's three issues. The first issue at the court's request is whether the trial court improperly extended its jurisdiction over an individual to modify a restitution order after the individual had been successfully discharged from probation. If the court does find that jurisdiction was proper, we would still submit that the restitution order was illegal and should be voided under Superior Court Rule 35A, and there's a few reasons for that. One of the reasons is that the three victims to whom restitution was ordered had already been compensated by Mr. Moore's insurance carrier. That's one of the reasons he paid for insurance premiums, and as submitted in the record in our appendix, there's proof that those people were paid.
So the amount that was ordered in restitution isn't simply an amount that's over and above the available insurance?
I would submit no in this case, Your Honor.
Well, is that a factual issue?
The answer is I don't know, Your Honor, and the reason is there was never a hearing for the restitution in this case.
Whose insurance company requested the $15,000, his or someone else's?
The $15,000 belonged to the victim's insurance carrier, Hartford. In this case, they were the PIP carrier. The only reason I know that, Your Honor, is with the court's permission, I was permitted to look in the pre-sentence investigation office file. There's nothing to that effect in the actual sentence order. It just says $15,000 to the Hartford.
Now, in your brief, you suggest that that carrier should collect from your client's carrier.
Correct, Your Honor.
Was any effort made to do that?
We contacted the Hartford to confirm that, and that was about a year ago. When we contacted the Hartford, they had no recollection of this case. They had nothing on their record suggesting that they were owed any restitution, any subrogation. At this point, I believe the subrogation statute of limitations has passed. As we actually attempted to try to resolve this informally with the carriers, just saying, we didn't know if this is on your records. Would you be willing to just waive it at this point as a record-keeping matter? And while the Hartford was receptive, they just never got back to us.
Mr. Meyerhoff, can you, again, move the microphone closer or speak louder?
Yes, sorry, Your Honor.
So who's owed the money? The carrier who paid the PIP?
Correct, Your Honor. $15,000 is owed to the Hartford.
They're owed money only because they didn't pursue a subrogation claim.
That's my understanding, Your Honor. And obviously under Delaware law, they can certainly pursue subrogation under Section 2118 of Title 21. This Court has said on numerous occasions, and I think it's clear from the statute itself, that an insured tortfeasor is insulated from having the victim's insurance carrier subrogate against him or her directly. That's the purpose of the statute. And the effect of the restitution order in this case for the $15,000 to, in essence, elevate form over substance, it permits the carrier to go against the individual in contravention of well-established Delaware law, in this case, Section 2118. And especially in this case, it eviscerates the statute of limitations. I mean, this accident occurred in April 2001. It's almost 10 years later. And theoretically, the Hartford is still permitted to get that money under the restitution order as it stands.
But they wouldn't be able to under civil recourse because the statute of limitations is run.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Of course, if we agree with your first argument, then the subrogation issue is moved. Is that correct?
That's true, Your Honor. So, yes, obviously, if the court rules that the restitution order should never have been modified as an improper exercise of the trial court's jurisdiction, because of his discharge then.
I think I heard you say that this modified or amended sentencing order that suddenly required substantial restitution, there was never a hearing to determine who owed whom what or why?
That's correct, Your Honor. And looking at the certified docket, we didn't get involved, to be honest, until February of 2009. And the reason we got involved is our client contacted us to say there was a tax refund. That was the first attempt to collect any restitution at all in this case for about 6.5 years.
That's the intercept that's referred to in the brief.
Correct, Your Honor. But in looking at the docket, it just looks like about 3-4 months after the discharge from probation, a restitution order was just modified.
You clerk for Superior Court, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
What is the practice? Is it a matter of course for a Superior Court judge to amend a sentencing order and order substantial restitution with no hearing?
My understanding is no, Your Honor. To be quite honest, I don't really recall sitting in many sentencing hearings. But in reviewing the statutes at issue, that would be Section 4106 of Title 11. The statute makes clear that there's supposed to be some type of evidentiary hearing. I know the court has in the past said that lost victim statements are sufficient to protect a defendant's due process rights. In this case, I don't know what victim loss statements were submitted. I don't know when they were submitted. I do not know when the trial judge heard them. All I know is that a modified sentencing order was issued.
Well, let's take your arguments, which seem to be in the alternative. First, you say there was no jurisdiction to do this. Now, let's move to the second argument, which I understand to be, if there was jurisdiction, there needed to be a hearing. And if there had been a hearing, this carrier would not have been eligible to have restitution. Is that correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
Because only the victims get restitution directly.
Correct, Your Honor. And part of that analysis involves the fact that Mr. Moore pleaded guilty and agreed to pay three victims. Those are the three people in the other vehicle in which he hit. The case law is clear in Delaware. Insurance carriers can certainly qualify as victims for restitution. I do not dispute that. But what I do dispute is Mr. Moore pleaded guilty and the court agreed to his plea agreement for the three victims. No insurance carriers were listed. No medical providers were listed. And then a few months after he was discharged from probation, those entities were suddenly appeared on the restitution order in a substantial amount, in this case over, almost $20,000, without a hearing, any basis for him to contest that. We would submit that that's illegal under Delaware law.
There's another policy issue here, isn't there? And that is if, in this case, the defendant's covered by insurance, which is available and obligated to pay after subrogation, why should the Delaware taxpayer and the court system be involved with restitution at all?
I certainly agree with that, Your Honor. My practice is obviously mostly focused on insurance law, and one of the arguments we put forth in the brief is Mr. Moore paid premiums for exactly this type of loss. The mens rea for the convictions of vehicular assault second is criminal negligence. There's no dispute as to coverage here. We submitted in our appendix proof that his carrier, AAA Mid-Atlantic, actually paid the victims at issue for civil claims and in substantial amounts, far beyond the restitution that was ordered. That's obviously a matter of the record. That's not disputed. So I certainly agree with Your Honor's position. In this case, that's the purpose of insurance. I certainly agree that Delaware taxpayers should not be involved in a case like this.
Mr. Meyerhoff, I want to go back to your jurisdictional argument. When we were talking about jurisdiction, we're talking about the court not having the power to do whatever it is it's complained of. Power to do that or not do it either flows from a statute or from some precept embedded in doctrine that nobody can question. I understand that the statute is silent on this issue.
Correct, Your Honor.
Is it correct to say that the basis for your jurisdictional argument is a precept, that is, that once Mr. Moore was discharged from probation, the court no longer had any jurisdiction over him because his sentence had been completed, and that being the case, the court couldn't then reach out and assert jurisdiction when its original jurisdiction had expired. Is that
yes, Your Honor? That's your argument. That's the argument in a nutshell. What's even more compelling in this case is if you look at the sentencing orders and worksheet, and this is in our appendix. This is at A16. For his charge of DUI, it says conditions: pay costs, fines, restitution during. There's a blank line, and then there's a box marked probationary period.
I'm sorry?
Probationary period. It shows that the restitution is to be paid during the probationary period. That's also in the March 7, 2002 order.
Okay, so the court originally had jurisdiction to impose restitution, but that jurisdiction extended, even under the terms of the sentencing order, only during the probationary period.
Yes, Your Honor.
And once that period expired, without any specific probationary, I'm sorry, specific restitutionary order, then that power was lost.
Correct, Your Honor. I think if the court had wanted to retain jurisdiction to modify the restitution order or permit the pre-sentence investigation office to complete any investigation it was going to complete, it certainly could have. Mr. Moore did agree in March 2002 to restitution, but I think it had to affirmatively retain jurisdiction to do that. And what I would note for that is if you look at Section 4333 of Title 11, it discusses how you can place somebody on accountability level one restitution only. I would submit that that's what the trial court should have done in this case, and then they could have easily modified restitution, and at that point they could have had a hearing. Mr. Moore could have then contested whether the Hartford or any other carriers or entities were or were not entitled to restitution, and that would have been appropriate, Your Honor.
Well, there's an earlier part of the statute that talks about restitution, in which would seem to imply even if you're discharged, you may have to continue making restitution. But I guess your point is it has to be quantified before the discharge.
Certainly, Your Honor.
You can't discharge someone from probation, as was done in this case, and then add to, in a sense, what the restitution had already been ordered.
That's correct, Your Honor. And there's certainly case law where defendants have been ordered a certain set number of restitution. Somehow later they violate that, and this court and other courts across the country have held that they certainly can modify it. The issue in those cases, and what I would suggest distinguishes this present case from those, is that Mr. Moore was never ordered any restitution. There was never any basis to affirmatively retain him for that number. And in that vein, Your Honor, I would submit, if you look at Section 414 of Title 11, that's the fines, costs, or restitution statute. Section A3 says costs or restitution shall be a condition of probation. In this case, probation should have, restitution certainly could have been ordered. It wasn't, and I would submit at that point, at his discharge from probation, there was no jurisdiction. And what's interesting
Is it your position that if you owe restitution and you're discharged from probation, any restitution you owe is extinguished?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. I would think if there was a certain amount of restitution, there was a hearing, there was evidence, and the court said you owe restitution in a certain number, $20,000 in this case for sake of argument, I think the statute would arguably be broad enough to retain jurisdiction.
So what you're saying is that once restitution is properly imposed during probation, that even if there's a discharge from probation, the court has continued jurisdiction under the statute to monitor the proper carrying out of the restitution order?
I think if it affirmatively retains jurisdiction, that's correct, Your Honor. I don't mean to backtrack. I think the statute at issue, Section 4104D, says the court shall retain jurisdiction over the convicted person until any restitution imposed shall have been paid in full.
So your point is that when you're about to discharge someone from probation, it's incumbent upon the court to find out whether restitution has been paid in full.
Certainly, Your Honor.
And then if you want to continue the restitution payment, if there's some outstanding, you simply make a notation that we're retaining jurisdiction until you finish restitution.
I think that's correct, Your Honor.
But in the absence of that, you'd be discharged and restitution would be extinguished. Is that your point?
Yes, Your Honor. And I think it's especially strong in this case. If you look at the appellant's appendix at A22, this is the probation court docket modification of sentence order. This is when Mr. Moore was successfully discharged in July 2002. There's a section that says, after a hearing before the court, the defendant shall pay restitution. There's a line through that section.
Let me follow up on Justice Holland's question, because there are really two situations, that is, two fact patterns that one could envision. One is that at the end of the probationary period, but before a discharge of probation, the court takes a look to see if restitution has been made. And if it has not been completed, then the court will not discharge or cannot discharge from probation until restitution is completed.
Yes, Your Honor.
That's one scenario. The other scenario is that the court, on those same facts, can go ahead and discharge the defendant from probation, but nonetheless, despite that, continues to have jurisdiction for the limited purpose of monitoring the full payment of restitution. Which scenario are you arguing, the first or the second?
The first scenario, Your Honor.
So your position is that if the court discharges the defendant without taking steps to assure that probation has been completely paid, then once that discharge takes place, the court loses jurisdiction, and even the statute doesn't continue the jurisdiction.
Excuse me.
And I'd just like you to go back to what you were reading that was crossed out about restitution. Tell us again what you're reading. And
this is page 822 of the appellant's appendix. It's the probation court docket modification of sentence order dated July 30, 2002, and that's signed by the trial judge. This says, there's an asterisk, effective July 30, 2002, defendant is discharged successfully from probation. And if you go up a little to section A, that's the section that discusses what restitution the defendant shall pay. The judge crossed, put a line through that. Didn't say to be determined later. Didn't say this is the amount. There's just a line through that as if Mr. Moore did not owe any restitution.
So the judge crosses out restitution in July, and several months later, we have this additional $19,000 added.
Correct, Your Honor.
Save the balance of your time?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor.
The police, the court.
Tim Donovan for the state. Obviously, I know there are a number of unusual aspects to this case. First of all, the defendant pleaded guilty to reduced charges in March of 2002. As part of the plea agreement, he agreed to make restitution to the three named individuals who were in the vehicle he struck. And the court sentenced him immediately to pay a fine and placed him on 1 year level two probation, with the proviso that when he had discharged his financial responsibilities, he could be discharged from probation. Now, several months later in July, a judge receives from probation and parole notification that the defendant had discharged those financial responsibilities that had been imposed, his fine and court costs in the amount of roughly $1,400. And the judge signed the discharge order. Then several months later, I believe in October, back at sentencing, the judge had then ordered the Office of Investigative Services, the pre-sentence office, to determine the appropriate amount of restitution. And there are procedures for doing this. And in the interim, if the procedures were followed, and here's where the facts get very hazy because there was no hearing below to determine the facts, but the pre-sentence office, after determining restitution, should have sent defense counsel what we think of is the appropriate restitution, giving the defense then a chance to challenge that. And if no agreement could be reached, then there would be a hearing. And it's unknown what happened in this period, but we do know that in October then, the judge, and this is the same judge that presided over sentencing, discharged, signed the discharge papers, and that same judge then ordered restitution in the amount of approximately $20,000, the lion's share of which goes to insurers, the Hartford.
So, Mr. Donovan, how do we make legal sense out of this mess?
Well, one major problem, and it's a problem that I have personally, is that factually, I mean, the facts just aren't there yet. We don't know what happened.
We do know in July, if we go back to this A23 that Mr. Meyerhoff just read, the judge seemed to say you're discharged from probation and crossed out restitution. Why wouldn't a reasonable person think they're done?
Well, why the judge did that, I do not know, but, I mean, I can't argue with the court's point. Well, I mean, I cannot.
Could it have been that the judge did that for the very reason that Mr. Meyerhoff suggested, and that is that his client had agreed to pay restitution to three individuals, and that he had, in fact, paid restitution to three individuals? The judge crosses out any further responsibility because that had been accomplished. Then later, a pre-sentence officer or a probation and parole officer raises the point, but we've got two insurance companies who haven't been reimbursed for what they paid on behalf of their insureds. They are a new element for restitution. No notice, no hearing, no idea that this defendant would ever have to pay restitution to those insurance companies. But right out of whole cloth comes an intercept for his income tax return on the theory that he owes restitution to people he was never told he would owe restitution. Isn't that what happened here? What's the factual mystery?
If the original sentencing order had ordered restitution to those three individuals, I would agree wholeheartedly, but there was no order of restitution in that original sentence. The sentence was restitution to be determined.
Well, what we were told by Mr. Meyerhoff was that when his client entered his plea, part of the plea agreement was that he make restitution to three individuals who were harmed in the accident. Is that correct or not correct?
In an amount to be determined.
But to three individuals?
Three individuals at an amount to be determined.
Not to two insurance companies and
no.
Three individuals?
Only three individuals.
And we're clear that factually the only money claimed now to be owed in restitution is money to be paid to two insurance companies.
That is correct. That is correct. As a matter of fact, I don't know that, well, no restitution. I'm not sure any of this restitution actually went to the individuals, any of the restitution that has been paid. It seems to me.
Well, the record suggests the trial judge thought it did because he crossed out restitution as a continuing requirement before discharge of probation.
In July, no restitution had been paid because none had been ordered yet. There had not been a dollar amount. The amount of money he was required to pay was strictly the $1,000 fine and $400 in court costs.
Do you agree that any amounts he would have owed these three individuals would have been paid by his own insurance carrier and probably was?
Probably was, yes.
So now, what restitution would he then owe
to the
three individuals?
Well, as far as restitution to insurance carriers, this court has held.
I'm not talking about insurance carriers. I'm talking about the three individuals for whom he promised, as a condition of entering his plea, he would reimburse by way of restitution, and his insurance carrier, to whom he paid a premium for that very purpose, reimbursed them.
Yeah.
How is he to know, or anyone to know, that at some later date there would be an order never discussed between him, his counsel, the court, probation, parole, pre-sentence office, or anyone else, there would be an order in multiple thousands of dollars out of the blue that he paid restitution to two insurance companies?
He is not to know. He would not know that. That would be out of the blue. And I should go back to that. We put down in that plea agreement, and I talked to the deputy and told her about this case, and she said, well, I never asked for reimbursement of insurance companies here. I wanted to make sure these three individuals, which of course is always our focus, we
sure
want to make sure these three individuals are made whole. Now, legally, the judge could order the insurance company to be reimbursed. Now, whether that's a good idea as a matter of policy, that's for the courts to decide. That's
well beyond
my pay grade.
You say legally the court could do it, but the question in this case is when. Why could the court do it in October, given the court order in July? Why could the court still do it?
Well, As far as being discharged from probation, leaving aside that the defendant may have been blindsided, as the Chief Justice suggests, by crossing off the restitution, say that had not been done, just the fact of being discharged from probation, I don't think it's material to the issue of whether the court can continue.
Why not?
Because probation and the statutes are clear on this, the requirement to pay restitution survives probation. You do not have to be on probation. You don't even have to be put on probation.
But there was no requirement in terms of any dollars before the discharge from probation. Doesn't that statute presuppose some sort of specific dollar amount that's been imposed?
Like I say, this is a highly unusual case, the way this went.
Let's go back to this highly unusual case in my specific question. In this highly unusual case where the judge says in July, you're discharged, no restitution, it's crossed out, why did the court have jurisdiction in October to order additional restitution to two insurance companies that no one had ever contemplated would even request restitution?
If the court will hold, and I don't see any law on this, that once, if a defendant is placed on probation, having previously agreed to make restitution, in an amount to be determined, and then is discharged from probation before that amount is determined, then the court loses jurisdiction later to issue an order with a specific amount of restitution. But there is certainly no law that I have found.
Now, I'm looking for the law that supports what the Superior Court did. You're here saying what the court did in October was entirely correct and it had jurisdiction to do it. My question is, what's your authority to support the court's jurisdiction to enter restitution in October when it signed an order telling the defendant he was done with restitution in July?
Well, the only case law on the subject is the one I said, and that's the Linton case, and that's a Superior Court decision on appeal from the Court of Common Pleas, which is factually on all fours to this case. And Superior Court's reasoning was that, again, under 4106 and other 4104, that jurisdiction over the person remains for the purpose of collecting fines, costs, and restitution, whether they're discharged from probation, put on probation to begin with or not.
But you're talking generally, and I'm trying to talk specifically. As a general proposition, I'm assuming what you just said is correct. In this case, where the only restitution that had been quantified was paid in full, and the court, in effect, in July said, you're done. We're not talking about something that had been quantified and was unpaid. We're talking about something that was quantified and is done. What's the court's authority in October for entering its order?
Let me just dispute that no restitution had been quantified whatsoever. The only monies the defendant was ordered to pay were a $1,000 fine and court costs. There had been no quantification of any restitution whatsoever. And I think I said before, if there had been, for example, well, preliminarily we'll say, $500 to Mrs. Seabird or whatever her name was, and then further restitution in amount to be determined or something, and the defendant had paid the $500 restitution and then received this July order, I would certainly agree that that
now,
certainly.
But maybe I'm confused on the record. At some point in time, restitution to the victims was made in the amount of $1,400. Is that correct?
No, that is incorrect. That was the fine and court cost. No restitution whatsoever was ordered.
Well, with regard to these three people in the accident, did they ever get restitution?
To their insurance companies. One, the woman who was driving, whose car it was, did submit a victim loss statement to the pre-sentence office. The other two did not. So only the driver, who was an elderly lady, and who the one who received the most damage, most injuries.
But that money was above the $1,400.
Yes, the $1,400 has nothing to do with restitution. No. It's a $1,000 fine and $400 in court costs.
But as I understand the record, at least the people in the probation office said he's paid his $1,400 fine. Whoever's asked for restitution has gotten it, whether we quantified it or not. They thought he was done.
My assumption, and again, it's an assumption, the people in the probation office just looked as far as finding court costs went and never even saw the restitution to be determined order. I mean, that's the only thing I can think of. I mean, it's one, and when the judge saw it, probably now several months had passed and probably forgot there was a probation or a restitution to be determined order, signed the discharge papers. And then several months after that, the pre-sentence office comes back and says, oh, by the way, there's these $20,000. It's a small matter of 20 grand here that needs to be paid to these two insurance companies, and the court ordered it.
And the court, as a matter of course, will order it simply because somebody in the probation department says, oh, by the way, Judge, this defendant, whose case is concluded, owes $20,000 to two insurance carriers. Enter an order of restitution. And then the income tax refund check is the only notice the defendant gets that he owes money, and he has to find out why his $3,000 tax refund has been blocked. Right. And that's the only notice he gets that he owes $20,000 restitution.
As a factual
matter.
Is that
the way the system's supposed to work?
No, if that's what happened. But there's a fact question here, and a very serious fact question.
What is it? What is the fact?
Which is, when did he or did he not know of this? I mean, there are procedures in the Superior Court rules for the pre-sentence office notifying defense counsel and the defendant of the preliminary.
What the record indicates to me from reading what we have is that his first notice was his huge surprise at the fact that his income tax refund had been intercepted in order to pay something up to that point he did not know he owed.
Oh, I mean, if that's the case, well, that's obviously unfair. I mean, that's inexcusable. But I don't know that it's a matter of fact.
That he never got a hearing before there was any quantification of.
But the rules contemplate that there be an objection.
That's one serious problem. The other serious problem is that, you know, as you have argued to us, there wouldn't be a jurisdictional issue if there had been a pre-probation discharge quantification of restitution. But here there wasn't. As you have conceded, there's been no quantification whatsoever. So we have two questions. Under what legal principle can the state justify the restitution order? On what basis can it stand?
The restitution order entered after the discharge from probation. But the state's position on that is that you don't even need probation to make a restitution order. And the fact that you're discharged from probation doesn't make any difference.
Well, you say that. But we're looking for a principle of law, authority, if you will, and I haven't heard any on the jurisdictional point. And secondly, even if there was jurisdiction, on what basis can we uphold the imposition of restitution to the insurance companies when that was done without a hearing?
The procedures that the court has established, the Superior Court, calls for the defendant to object to the restitution that is being proposed and then demand a hearing and, of course, then have a hearing. But the ball is the defendant's court. Now,
it's hard to object to something you don't know has happened.
If that's the case, that's why it's unfair,
well,
obviously.
It's the state that keeps the record. If that's contrary to fact, then where's the record?
The defendant has the obligation to make a complete record, but in this case, there should have been a hearing in Superior Court to determine these
and
facts.
Isn't it also the case that Superior Court judges do not discharge people from probation unless they have something cross their desk from the probation office, a pre-form of order for discharge and a recommendation from a probation officer that they be discharged.
Yes.
Superior Court judges don't discharge people from probation as a matter of will.
No, I'm sure the judge here got the discharge papers from probation department saying that the fines and financial obligations have been discharged and the judge signed it. I'm sure that's what happened.
And at that point, the defendant here would have objected to what?
No, at that point, nothing. Meanwhile, pre-sentence office, different department entirely, is going about its job of finding out the restitution.
Well, but at this point, the defendant knows he's been discharged from probation
yes.
with the attendant financial responsibilities, because that's what the order says.
Yes.
So I'm still trying to figure out why he should be poised on the balls of his feet waiting to object to something.
At some point between that period and October, if the rules were followed, the pre-sentence office sent him a proposed restitution, as him and his attorney, he's represented by counsel,
well,
and that they could then object to and demand a hearing before the court.
Well, if the rules were followed, there never would have been a discharge from probation, because there would have been a clear understanding on the part of the state that if there were to be restitution quantified at some point, not only would there be an amount of restitution that the defendant would be told he had to pay, but he would be further surprised because for the first time he would have been told, after he had entered his plea conditioned on restitution to three individuals, he would have been given the new news that he was also being ordered to pay their insurance carriers. He, a person who had provided insurance for others if he injured them by way of paying a premium of his own, rightfully thinking that to the extent there would be restitution, it would be paid by his own insurance carrier. So are we supposed to sit up here and let this Alice in Wonderland world be the way in which the state works? I mean, this is incredible. Absolutely incredible.
But I can say that this court has held in Pratt v. State that insurance carriers can be considered victims in addition to the actual flesh and blood victims. And I see my time is up, but...
I don't think the issue is whether or not under a discrete set of circumstances an insurance carrier could apply for status as a victim who's owed restitution. That could easily be the case, I would suspect, when the defendant has no insurance carrier of his own.
Sure.
But it seems, I think, to a reasonable person that when you have a civil system arranged for subrogation and for insurance companies to arbitrate disputes about who owes who what, or who owes which what, I suppose, in their case, that why is the criminal justice system funded by the taxpayer serving as a collection agency for an insurance carrier?
I cannot disagree. I cannot disagree. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just wanted to clarify something that Justice Holland had asked. Excuse me. At this time, Mr. Moore has paid the one victim that turned in her loss statement sheet, Ms. Siebert. That's paid $488, and according to my conversations...
A little louder, Mr. Meyerhoff.
I apologize. Mr. Moore has paid the restitution owed to the one victim of the three who turned in her loss statement sheets. That check was cashed in April 2009. Of the amounts owed to AAA, he's paid $3,268. That's in our appendix at A53. I confirm that also. So Mr. Moore has, as far as the restitution order is concerned, the three victims, two didn't turn in their loss statement sheets. The one who did has been paid, not to mention the compensation she received through Mr. Moore's insurance carrier.
You indicated that you looked through the pre-sentence investigation record.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Have you seen the probation department records?
No, Your Honor. I was given permission to review the pre-sentence file I wasn't allowed to copy anything. This was almost 2 years ago. I certainly remember reviewing it.
Have you seen anything from the Prothonotary's office as a matter of record notifying your client that a later restitution order ordering restitution to two insurance carriers either would be entered but for some response from him or had been entered?
No, Your Honor.
Is it correct? The record reflects that his first notice was when he found out his income tax refund check had been intercepted on the theory that he owed money to the court.
Yes, Your Honor. That's the first time that my client learned of this. I do not know why I don't know whether his former attorney did receive or did not receive notice. I can tell you my client informed me explicitly he did not receive notice and first learned of any outstanding amounts in February 2009. From his view, everything had been resolved. I had been on the phone with his insurance carrier because, as I mentioned before, we do insurance work. That's what I thought this was. I didn't realize it was a restitution issue. I know for a fact that his insurance carrier did pay all the amounts owed to the victims. So he did not learn of this for almost 6.5, 7 years later. One of the issues that I raised in the brief, and I'm not going to focus on it very largely here, was the Harris v. State case. And I know the speedy sentence constitutional provision, it hasn't been officially approved. But there's an argument that we think makes sense, which is it's been nearly 7 years. He didn't learn of anything. That certainly violates his right to have his sentence executed in a speedy manner.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.